one by one, elite athletes at the peak of physical condition are collapsing on the field. Some of them are literally dropping dead. Last January, Brazilian soccer player Alex Apolinario died on the field. In June, Italian soccer player Giuseppe Parrino died of a heart attack during a game. Oh, and you'll love this. PolitiFact says none of this could be related to any vaccination because news articles don't mention it. Really great and advanced reporting there. In July, two West Indies cricket players collapsed on the pitch within 10 minutes of each other. In the UK, cricketer Josh Downey died of a random heart failure at age 24 during practice, because that's normal. Well, in the same country, a Youth Football Association Cup was suspended when one of the young players at a youth association game had a heart attack mid-game. You'll remember this one. In September, former New Orleans Saints linebacker Paris Harrelson died of a heart attack at age 37. That same month at the University of Ottawa, football player Francis Perron died abruptly after the team's opening game. In Columbia, South Carolina, two high school football players died suddenly within a week of each other. Tennis pro Jeremy Chardy, one of the top 100 in the world, says that since getting vaccinated, his health has deteriorated so badly that he cannot train and he cannot play. Italian volleyball champion Francesca Marcone says she can't play either due to side effects from this bioweapon. And we could go on like this for a long, long time. There are news stories like this every few days. And do all of them have something to do with so-called COVID vaccines? Well, we don't know. But there is clearly a real wave of this going around, and people are noticing. The powers that be, of course, say it's all a coincidence. But keep in mind, these are the same people who tried to ban, even suggesting, that COVID came from a lab. They aren't doctors. They're propagandists, straight out of 1984. Well, Dr. Peter McCullough isn't a propagandist. He's a real cardiologist, a real epidemiologist, a real internist. And throughout this pandemic, he has refused to let a bunch of hacks tell him how to practice medicine. And he says there is no coincidence going on here and that these young athletes are dropping dead due to myocarditis. Dr. Peter McCullough joins us now. Thank you for being here. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Is it time to just stop this for kids, for young people, until we get this all sorted out?
Stu, we desperately need a report, and all these rash of deaths, which is absolutely alarming. I've seen montages of death after death on the field, a lot of European, ex-US, but now in the US, athletes. And we desperately need who's taken the vaccine and when. I commented with Rob Mitchell on his show before the Olympics, we had data that 80% of the Olympians had taken one of the vaccines. And of course, they're all very different. But now that we know that with the messenger RNA vaccines, there's official FDA warnings for myocarditis in a paper by Jessica Rose and myself from In Current Problems of Cardiology, we know now the myocarditis reported in the VAERS system extends up to age 50. So it's not just exclusively in younger individuals. And you know, with myocarditis, when it exists in any form, a part of the treatments due is no physical activity for about 3 to 6 months. So these athletes know if they report signs and symptoms of myocarditis, they know that they're out for the season. My worry is that these young people are taking the vaccines, they're forced into it, and the risk period starts, and we don't know how long it lasts for myocarditis. It may be just a few weeks or months or longer, that in fact they have subclinical symptoms or mild symptoms, don't report it. And then with the physical activity, notice most of the deaths are not occurring off the field. They're actually in competition, that in fact it's driving cardiac death. Still, we don't see this anymore because the former leading cause of athletic sudden death is called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. Now there's almost uniform screening through high school, college, and professional levels. We don't have young kids at risk go out in the field with this congenital form of a cardiomyopathy. And so, you know, we're not used to seeing sudden deaths on the field like this. And now the world is shocked.
There's only one thing that has changed in our world since this uptick, and it's the rollout of these shots. I mean, we have to be honest about that. Is there any reason to believe? Now, it's tragic that these athletes are dropping over. It's tragic that people in top peak physical condition are dying, especially during the middle of competitions. I mean, all of that is tragic. These are family members that are lost. They probably didn't need to be. But I want to talk about our kids. Is there any reason to believe that this myocarditis uptick will not be apparent or affect small children as well? I mean, this is going to affect them as well, is it not?
There has been descriptions of myocarditis before the COVID-19 vaccines and from Finland. There's a good study from Finland in one of the major cardiology journals, 2018, I believe. And there it's clear that there is an age dependency and risk. There's very little spontaneous myocarditis due to other viruses like parvovirus, for instance, in the age groups of under 5 or 5 to 11. All the action is really over age 11 up through the teenage years, and it really does pick up there. And in that study, again, before the COVID-19 vaccines, far more in boys than girls. It must be 8 to 2 boys to girls, and it must be related in some fashion to puberty and androgens and their effects on the heart. We see the same blossoming, by the way, of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy in puberty. So putting that together, there is going to be no doubt about it. If the children ages 12 to 17 are vaccinated in large numbers, if that happens, paper by Tracy Hogan, colleagues, University of California, Davis, suggests that there will be far more hospitalizations for myocarditis. We know in the Hogue paper, 86% of these cases are so serious, the kids have to be in the hospital, which is very, very serious. For to hospitalize a teenager, for instance, is very rare. We know this is a serious complication, that it's far more likely to be hospitalized with vaccine-induced myocarditis than actually be hospitalized with COVID-19, the respiratory illness, because it's so mild in that age group.
Which I have right now. I was telling you before we came on. Apparently, I have the set of symptoms being branded and marketed as this China virus. No big deal. We'll get through it. Question. These doctors, these so-called doctors, these zombies with stethoscopes, how do you see them justifying this uptick in young myocarditis patients?
I interviewed for the McCullough Report just last night, Dr. Mark McDonald, who's a psychiatrist in Los Angeles. His new book is out, and the term in the title of his new book, Stu, is mass psychosis. And McDonald thinks that, in fact, physicians are swept up in what's considered a mass psychosis, meaning that they've had the critical elements. By the critical elements are having a period of time of lockdown and isolation, being taken away from things that one enjoys. That's number two. Number three is actually free-floating anxiety. And then actually they're offered, the number four, the capper, is they're offered a solution, a single solution, the vaccine. And in this theory, the theory gets credit actually to Dr. Matthias Desmet at University of Ghent in Belgium. He says that there is no limit to the absurdity in the solution. So in a sense, our solution is the vaccine, but the absurdity of it is the fact the vaccines are so unsafe and that we've had just enormous numbers of deaths and non-fatal complications. And in this mass psychosis, doctors still continue to encourage patients to take these vaccines.
Why are we even calling them vaccines, Dr. McCullough?
It's the wrong term. In fact, Dr. David Wiseman, former J&J scientist who's testified now at multiple FDA meetings, continues to emphasize to the FDA that these are gene transfer technologies, and they're classified by the FDA gene transfer technologies. And with that, they actually have their own sets of special regulatory standards, including much longer term follow-up. You know, as a cardiologist, Stu, I can prescribe a messenger RNA drug. There is one that exists. It's called patirisan. And patirisan is used to treat amyloidosis, but it is a gene transfer technology product. So if I use it, as a doctor, I must consider that it's a gene transfer technology product. When Pfizer, Moderna are administered, you're right, they should be considered as gene transfer technology products. They are transferring the gene into the human body that codes for the dangerous Wuhan spike protein that we know everything about. This spike protein is dangerous. It damages the brain, the heart, the other vital organs, damages blood vessels, causes blood clots. Now there's data from China showing that the S2 segment of the spike protein actually interacts with two cancer genes, P53 and the BRCA gene. So the concern now is one or two injections, probably not enough exposure, Stu, but we start to get to boosters now every 6 months and loading the body with spike protein. Each injection probably takes a year and a half to get it out of the body. We are going to accumulate spike protein and probably cause a giant new basically chronic disease epidemics of these degenerative diseases, including cancer.
With everything that you're saying, do you see any reason to continue with this shot program for kids? I mean, adults are going to have their own choice, whatever. If you know what you know about this thing and you still choose to go get it, I guess that's on you. I'll stay away from you because I'm sure it's one of these so-called vaccinated super spreaders that I got my Rona from here. But, you know, for kids, should there just be a flat out a ban? Stop this right now.
I think many of the other countries that have at least banned Moderna, but across the board, we should just go ahead and leave the children out of it. I've been on national TV telling America now for months, leave the children out of it. Do you know at the FDA meetings on two occasions now, that in the meeting minutes, the general agreement was through May that 40% of American kids have already had COVID-19 and you can't get it a second time. Finally, our CDC admits through a Freedom of Information Act request, they don't have a single case of someone getting COVID-19 a second time and ever passing it to anybody. And so now through the Delta outbreak, my estimates are 80% of children have already had COVID-19. They can't give it to anybody. And we know that's due because right now all the kids are back at school. No outbreaks, none. I was at a symposium recently with Scott Atlas, who presented the data to the group in Columbus, Ohio, showing that the safest profession in the world right now is to be a kindergarten or junior high teacher around kids all day long because the kids are an immunologic buffer. So under no circumstances should children in any position basically be mandated or forced to take these vaccines. Sadly, there are children who die of COVID-19. There's been about 600, but it's the same group that died with influenza. And we can't stop that either. And it's because they have cystic fibrosis or terminal cancers or other sad conditions. But by and large, young, healthy children can be well managed with COVID-19. The vast majority need nothing whatsoever. But even if there's serious, severe symptoms, do you know, we use inhaled budesonide, albuterol, some azithromycin, even methylprednisolone, weight-dosed aspirin. We always get the kids through it, even on severe symptoms. No indications for a vaccine.
We have heard a story here recently of a set of parents taking their 8-year-old daughter in to get this shot, and she didn't want this shot, and they literally had to pin her down. She was screaming, physically fighting. They had to pin her down, and she was screaming and yelling about how she knows about these athletes that are dying from this thing. She didn't want it. She's 8 years old. The trauma that those parents have now put this child through and the long-lasting, irreversible damage that they could have done to their child as a result of this, I think there's going to be a lot of parents in dire straits emotionally, psychologically, after their kids start to experience the irreparable, long-lasting, dangerous side effects from these shots. It's my opinion that they just need to stop altogether for kids. I don't see any reason why kids, and you mentioned the 600 that have died. This program has looked into those 600. All of them had serious pre-existing underlying conditions because that's what led to the serious reaction to this so-called virus. But the virus is virtually not dangerous and affects no kids virtually at all. Is that right?
That's true. In fact, I think analyses by Scott Jensen, separately by Marty Macri from Johns Hopkins show, we think there's one child who was previously healthy who died of COVID-19. And sadly, that one didn't get any early treatment. That one could have been saved. But you're right. There are children, it's rare, who have cystic fibrosis, these other conditions. And the bottom line is it's the same number that would succumb to influenza. In fact, last year we heard there was very relatively little influenza, and it was kind of a net-net. By and large, the children should be left alone. You talked about this idea of two parents forcing their child to take a vaccine. If we know, in fact, there's more likely to be harm than any benefit, that actually could be characterized as personal assault or personal injury. But the most common situation we see is when there's divorced parents and one parent wants the vaccine and the other one doesn't. Remember, the vaccines are research. So the parents need to understand they're trying to force their child into research. I think the safest and most conservative approach is to defer on the vaccines and just be ready to treat COVID-19 if it occurs. That way, no one's harmed. You're right. If a vaccine is taken, the vast majority of people take the vaccines have no injury.
The scary part about all of this is that the media tells these parents that ivermectin is a horse dewormer paste and that people are crazy if they try to use it. The Nobel Prize winning ivermectin, it did not get a Nobel Prize for saving the Kentucky Derby. Okay. So these are just huge lies. Joe Rogan called out the CNN top medical contributor right on his program and said, "What? How do you feel about working for a network that just consistently lies to people?" And so all of these treatments, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, the aspirin, the things that you spoke about here, these things, vitamin D, C, quercetin, zinc, all the things that the top experts in the world are talking about how this has been treated successfully are being demonized by the media. Do you have any idea or any reason why that might be? I mean, obviously, I'm thinking that it's because 70% of the budget for these media conglomerates comes from pharmaceutical companies. So obviously, they don't want to speak out against that or offer any alternative to these shots. Do you think that's what it is?
I told Tucker Carlson that, honestly, now about 6 months ago. I think the suppression of early treatment is really designed to promote fear, suffering, isolation, hospitalization, and death, actually by design, in order to prepare the patient, the population to accept mass vaccination. And that's honestly, that was my opinion 6 months ago. And it's not just the media, Stu. Do you know, beginning of September, the American Medical Association announced an initiative to abolish the use of ivermectin. Abolish. Stu, since when does the AMA try to abolish the use of it? AMA is not a treatment organization. That's a physician political organization. They have no role in recommending or not recommending treatments. Fortunately, the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons shot back a letter, cease and desist. Ivermectin supported by over 63 clinical studies. It's front line in Japan. Japan is even more sophisticated than America in its medical response. It's first line in Japan because it's so effective. It squashed the curves down in Mexico, South America, across India. Now, ivermectin is part of a sequenced multi-drug approach for COVID-19. You mentioned Joe Rogan. I'm going to be on with him next week. We'll go over the protocol. Joe received exactly how I drew it up for America and for the world in the two seminal publications I had last year in 2020 on sequential multi-drug treatment for COVID-19. It's actually now copyrighted as the McCullough protocol. And it's important to realize no single drug is necessary nor sufficient to treat COVID-19. We put the drugs in combination. You're going to be on a combination of drugs just like I was, and you'll be delivered through the illness just fine.
I believe that. Thank you. And I appreciate that. I appreciate everything that you're doing, and so does all of America, the sane people in this country. Dr. Peter McCullough, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you.